Access number 1938, Rule 26.
Off? Yes, I'm off.
Mr. G. Eyston, Reel 26. What was the health of the troops like in the box, Mr. Eyston?
Well, naturally, in a situation like that, there's a lot of desert sores. These are carried by flies in a lot of cases. They're any little scratch, and the fly gets to it. It nearly always finishes up with a desert sore. And the answer for that was sulfolamide. Anyway, a yellow ointment, which they scraped on and tried to scrape the disease away. And keeping it clean as possible. Any cut had to be more or less covered, otherwise you get those desert sores. And desert sores are things that spread fast. It's, I suppose in a sense, it's like a mild cancer, skin cancer, because the skin is burnt to start with. And if you've got a little cut on it, then the flies come, they love blood. And before you know where you're at, you've got a massive red sore, about five times the size of what you started with. So any cut really had to be covered. So possibly the MO and his staff were really under pressure just through these desert sores. And I believe that if they did get really, well, it was, if it got serious, it was a hospital case. And you weren't treated too gently, I understand, if you had to go to hospital with them, because they had a feeling that there was a lack of hygiene to a certain extent. You couldn't help the odd one coming around. But if you got a mass of these things, it was generally put down to being not hygienic. And then, of course, there's water play. Now, how they played war, when you think that we had half a gallon of water for everything each day, it takes a bit of believing, but they weren't happy. They weren't too pleasant, I don't believe, if you went to hospital with desert sores or anything like that. The flies were really, well, you just can't describe it. It's a continual itch. And if you scratch, of course, then they get blood and the flies are in again and they're carrying the sores. The ideal thing, which some people did manage to bring loads of if they got to Cairo, was the old horsetail swish. And that would, it was just like a tail. And you could swish it around. There was various things. We made various things with bits of flimsy petrol can and holes pumped through it so that the air went through. Because if you've got anything flat, it just pushes the fly away. Which is all right for your face, but anything like that. But you can't swat a fly. You can't kill a fly with anything flat. So we put holes through the flimsies and put a bit of wood on and made a handle, and they worked a bit. But the ideal thing, if you get hold of one, was like a horse's tail on a bit of wood. And that made things reasonably pleasant, but of course you couldn't be doing that all day. If you were working on in an engine with your head down, you couldn't be getting up and getting a horse tail to swish your face with. So you got used to it to a certain extent, and if you see photos today of the kiddies in the camps, refugee camps today, and they're absolutely covered with flies, and they're taking a bit of notice. And I suppose the skin gets a little bit tough, and it does, well, possibly the nerves get used to it, and you don't feel it as much after a while.
Did they make eating food difficult?
Yes, they were always there if you had a food. They were always around the corner of your mouth if you were eating. Where the corner of the mouth is a bit damp as you're eating the corner of the mouth. So they were always there. And of course, like the cold spot today, the desert sore used to very often start there and then spread up wherever it was a chance to get through. It only started if the skin was damaged. Normally the skin would, you didn't get the desert sore unless there was some entry for the fly to poke its tongue. Sand, of course, towards the end of April, the weather changes, you're getting colder nights, well, cold nights, and hotter days, and the wind coming from the south brings the Kamsheen up. The Kamsheen is a wind which brings a dust storm with it. And if it's a real one, there's just no visibility at all. You can't see anything. A half reasonable one, you'll get maybe a 20-yard visibility. But if it is a real one, there's no visibility at all. You can barely see your hand in front of. Worse than the smog in London, much worse. And of course, it stings as well because it's sand. It's not a fog. It's not a moisture thing. It is sand that is blowing, not moist. And in places, you could actually stand in brilliant sunshine and see this wall maybe 20, 30 feet high going past you. You're hoping it's not going to come down on you. You could actually stand and see about 30 yards away. You've got this well, more than 30 yards, 100 yards away. You could see it going past, maybe about 30 feet high. And it dwindles off, gets lighter towards the top as a rule. But it's a terrible sight when you know it's coming towards you. And everything, it didn't matter what it was and how you covered things, it would get dust. So they say you should eat a load of muck before you die, and we certainly ate ours, I think. In fact, I was just reading the other day where one or two now people who develop cancers are blaming the desert for their cancers because the sand has been there so long that there's development of cancer. I don't know. I don't let it get in among these things, really. But there certainly is this thing going on. While we're talking about that, there is another one where people were troubled with the bottoms, the anus. And worms were coming out. Actually out, not stomach worms, but worms working their way around and coming out. And these worms are supposed to have been in because men walked around bare-shod in the desert and the worms got in the feet. And it's taken them 30 years to work from the feet up and come out at that particular pace. That is fact. There's no rumour about that. That is fact. I met quite a few people who have had this problem in the last, 10 years ago anyway. I met quite a few people who had had this problem. It takes some believing. But of course, a piece of shrapnel can take up to 10 years to work its way from one spot to another before it really gets dangerous. So, amazing things happen. the dust was, you just can't describe it. I mean, we used to wear scarves around our mouths and nose, and that's uncomfortable because the moisture from your mouth and nose, that makes it unpleasant to start with. But it was the only thing you could do, really. Otherwise, you were chewing this dust and it got in your teeth and it was there all the time. Your tongue was coated with it. I did mention in the last tape about the bread coming in from Tobruk. It was a shame. It was beautiful bread, but always coated with dust. And no fault to the drivers or the people who made it. It was just purely that the dust was there and there was nothing to do about it.
Was there any other unpleasant aspect of life in the box which you found difficult or not so easy to cope with?
Well, there was a certain amount of boredom because I can't just remember the hours now, but the nights come down in about half an hour. There are no real twilights the way we know a twilight in this country. We know it's starting to come dark, and within half an hour it is dark. And I can't remember the times, but it's pretty near being equal, the amount of daylight and the amount of night. There is a little bit of extra time in summer, but not a great lot. So the nights, I suppose by about 8 o'clock, from the top here I'm speaking now, I suppose from 8 o'clock till 7 o'clock the next morning, you were in darkness. So there was some boredom about that. That was when we were in the box. If we're out on the jock column, of course, you were preparing for patrols going out and coming back again and waiting for them and listening to any aircraft that go over and things like that, which is a different thing altogether. But in the box, the nights were a little bit tedious. We did start getting some Stella beer used to come through, fairly reasonable. That was a local Cairo Alexandrian brew. And there was an air for it in the army, and still goes, I think. It was very weak compared to the drink that we were used to. But it was still palatable because the water was as I've said many times, the water was brackish, really brackish, unless we got to a place where the water was, to the cisterns where the water was, a burr. So the Stella came through, and then later we started getting Australian and Canadian and American beer. Well, that was purely gas. With the heat of the desert and the shaking up of it getting there, it was never allowed to settle. It had to be drunk straight away, more or less. So, in fact, there was more wasted than there was drunk, because as soon as you took the top off, it was all over the place. Just like the champagne bottle for the motor races now, which grieves me when I see that happening. But I still think, when I see it happening on the motor races, when the driver sort of blows the cork out and loses all the champagne, it was just the same with these bottles of beer that we were getting. There was Dow, Black Horse. I suppose there were about seven different brands of beer came up. They all tasted the same because they were all gas. But there's Canadian, Australian and American.
Was there any place actually within the box that you could go to and relax in? You know, something similar to a nappy kind of place at home?
No.
You were basically doing all your drinking and leisuring in your little slits and holes.
I thought it was Christmas Eve, but New Year's Eve, but it can't have been. There was one day I set off from the box to go to the Naffy to Brook, and I loaded up with beer, spirits and various things for the sergeant's mess, and I brought it back to the sergeant's mess. They did have a dug-in tent, and I brought it back to the sergeant's mess, and went inside and sent me two bottles out. And it was the Barnard Castle, it was the RQMS then, and then only, RQMS Barnes. And with the RSM being away, he was in charge. And I was very disappointed he wouldn't let me in the mess. It's the only time I've really been heard about not taking rank. And I was really hurt that night, because I'd really flown down and flown back in. It was some party you were having. I thought when he was here, but it can't have been. Anyway, they were having this do in the sergeant's mess, in the box. And he wouldn't let me in the mess. I was very upset about that. However, I got two or three bottles of beer out of it. And normally, this was a thing that happened, that somebody would take a truck down and they would bring a bottle back for the PRI, the way I used to do it in France from Poix. Somebody would take a truck down to the Naffy, the bulk Naffy, and bring a load back, and then it would be sold generally by the padre or one of his understood. Somebody he'd handed over to somebody else maybe to sell it. Or it maybe sort of rationed out the companies.
How and, were you paid in the box? Regular pay, parade kind of thing?
I don't remember. We got some money, there's no doubt about that, because we didn't get much. But certainly there was some, because one officer lost it. Well, it was said it was lost. We knew where it was, but to all accounts and purposes, it was lost in the retreat. So there was quite a bit of money, I believe. So there was money around, and we used to get this beer up, which had to be paid for. Toothpaste, shaving soaps, razor blades, things like that, they had to be paid for. Sally Army came in a few times, and these girls, I must really praise them, because they came in the shot and fire and everything.
They came into the box?
They came into the box on two or three occasions. And a good cup of tea, which was strange, with good water.
Where did they come from?
Well, I suppose they were based in Tobruk. But anyway, they came up, and sandwiches, which were good sandwiches, and bits and pieces, writing paper, And now there's a new innovation here when we got to Gazala. The Army Post Office brought a form out, which was numbered, and you put your address on and pick these numbers out, and then that was sent off. And I suppose it was transmitted by radio, and the numbers were just ticked off and printed when it got back to the country. And letter cards, they came, they had supplies of those. A pencil was a great thing, you know. We didn't have a lot of pencils. There must have been a typewriter somewhere, but I never saw it. I don't know who had that. And I just can't imagine, but I think there must have been one. It must have been in battalion headquarters, in rear headquarters, which was in B echelon at Cromer, where, 15 miles out of the box, I should think, maybe more. All the brigade B echelons, that was the QM stores and the battalion headquarters, the rear headquarters, and the fitters and extra petrol. In fact, all the truck, any truck that we didn't need in the box that wasn't being used to go out on patrol and collect rations and things like that, they were all sent back to the B echelon, and they were all at Cromer under brigade control.
Was there anyone else coming into the box? And you've said Salvation Army. Do you recall anyone else coming in outside of the normal troops and Army personnel?
Not. There was somebody. Oh, I don't know. No, I think that was later. We did have an ENSA party came round. I drove them for 4 days, 2 girls and 2 men. Well, I think that was later. That was up there, further up. No, I don't recall. I think there was another canteen came in once or twice, but I can't think. Oh, was it? I've got a feeling it was a South African ladies' thing. They came in a few times, but I'm a bit vague on that one. I think one thing I should mention probably the skies and the stars. I believe I did mention the stars. They are really prolific. There are massive stars, and I did say if you got to know them right, they could be a great help. Another thing about the desert was when we're doing patrols out on the jock columns, remarkable scents. Like a marguerite or a herb. And going on the desert, you suddenly go off the limestone. The top half, where the ridges were and the coast, was limestone, which was fairly hard and good to travel on. But as you worked down the desert, going south, it simply hit more sandstone. And in the sandstone in particular, in fact, all the way down, you would hit patches of like heather or a heather-like thing. It wasn't heather, but something similar to heather. And during the hot weather, there would just be the stalks there. Not stalks, but hard, well, heather stalks, yes. It was just like heather, in fact. And in one place, a bit further up the desert, there was juniper trees. Bushes, not trees, bushes. And there was this a scent which is hard to describe, but I just thought of it there. It's like one of the herbs that we use quite a lot. But it's gone. A unique smell for the desert. And there was all sorts of little flowers on a morning. You'd see little flowers. You didn't see much through the day. But on a morning, you could see little flowers in there, just peeping through the sand. It's an amazing place, really.
Was there any aspect of the desert that fascinated you?
Well, this did. And there's a certain amount of wildlife, not very much, but there was a certain amount of wildlife. There were a few gazelles maybe further south than we were, but there were gazelles on there. And the scorpions, I think I did mention before. Quite a lot of beetles, nasty things. And, of course, the flies. And the shy dogs. They were always there. Scavengers there. buzzards.
Did you have any leave at any time during the
period you were there? We used to get 4 days leave in, some went to Cairo, some went to Alexandria, to a rest camp called Sidi Bish, I think it was about 5 miles from Alexandria. And you had 4 days from arriving there. And we were fortunate that 6 of us got leave together. It was Corporal Handley, the musician I mentioned, he was the MT. And Jimmy Clark, he was a Scotch lad, he was the technical storeman. Titchy Brownless and Tommy Russ, Corporal Tom Russ, they were from Barnet Castle, from B Company. Well, Tom was then in the anti-tank. There was Tommy Buff, one of the first drafts we got, one of the first Scotch drafts we got at, it happened before I got back from France. Rugeley, they joined the battalion there. And Tommy had been with us ever since, and he was with us still after I left, because I'd letter from him after I got knocked up in Sicily. So the 6 hours, we went off together, and we were talking about money a while ago. Well, I know what I had £72 for the 4 days, which was a terrific amount of money in those days. And we got through the lot. So, it accumulated, because we're still on, I think. I don't know whether that a raise or not, quite honestly, but I think we're still on about 10-6 a week on a flat rate. But as soon as I got in the box at Gazala, I went off for 14 days to the 151 Brigade LAD. And there I took my vehicle mechanics course, vehicle mechanics test, which put me on trade pay. So then I was almost as much as a sergeant was. And this was the thing that, one thing that really didn't worry me about not being a sergeant, except for the case I've just mentioned when I was barred from the mess.
Were you still a private?
Yes. I was corporal a bit later on. But I was private then.
What was Sidi Bish like? Can you describe?
Well, Sidi Bish was a mass of soft sand. And there were tents here, the Indian tents, just the same as we'd had at El Quassassin. It was a transit camp, but it was a posh transit camp. They'd managed to get beds in and one or two more bits and pieces to make life better. And there was good meals, which we hardly ever had in camp, but there were good meals. And Sidi Bish was on the delta side of Alexandria. Alexandria is more or less just a strip of land which joins the desert to the edge of the delta, and behind it there are massive salt lakes. Whether the salt lakes were man-made to collect salt or not, I don't know, but it takes believing, because one of them is about 30 miles long and 5 miles wide, which had been there for donkey's years, and it takes a bit of believing that it was man-made, but it could have been. And you could actually see the salt drying on the edges anyway. You could see the salt drying. And there was roads across it running east and west. It actually was about 25 miles from east to the west, just about 5 miles behind the sea side of Alexandria. And all of Alexandria stretched to about, maybe 30 miles on this strip of land, about 5 miles wide. And Sidi Bish was going towards the delta, not quite out of Alexandria. In fact, it was the last stage of the tram car. The tram car ran from Ramleh to Sidi Bish. And I think that was something like 15 miles. No.
What facilities had the camp for you?
Well, we were in tents, and we got a good wash and a brush up, and our clothes brushed down a bit. And then, just over the ridge, maybe 400 yards, you came to the seashore. And on the seashore, there was a cafe where you could get coffee and cognac. And then we'd go and have a swim in the sea and come back again, have some more coffee and cognac, and then we'd maybe go back to the camp and change, ready to go off for the day. Now, the first thing we did when we got into Alex, into the centre, would be to go to a valley, and we'd have a shave and a wash and a brush up, and while we were being shaved and so forth, the uniforms were being pressed, the KD was being pressed, and the shirts and trousers came up, and everything, the shoes were cleaned, boots were cleaned. So that was the first thing, was to go in and see the valley.
Was this a private?
A private, yes. Yeah, so it cost money, you know, it was all part of the 72 quid's worth. And then we'd start and have a good drink somewhere. One of our favourite places in the afternoon anyway was the Kit Kat Club. That was on the front. And we'd have a good drink. And poor little Nobby was a Salvation Army lad, Nobby Clark was a Salvation Army lad. And we'd get a good drink into him. And by the time we decided it was time for something to eat, Nobby was drunk. So we just laid him out on the marbles. Food counter where the meat should have been. We just stretched him out on there while we had a meat. Now we'd pick him up after our meal, we'd go off again. We'd maybe go and look at something like one of the gardens, or we might even go and see a film, because there were good film cinemas, not open air cinemas the way we used to have, but these were posh to what we've been used to recently. And there was shows. Lots of clubs, and the English people who were there, there wasn't a terrific amount of English people in Alice, but there was quite a few. I believe we were barred from the Navy Club, I don't know, but I think the troops were actually barred from the Navy Club. There must have been a bit of a problem there at one stage.
Was there ladies available for those that wanted them?
There was a street, a name which I can't remember now. In fact, I believe that was another sister street, Rue de Sœur, I'm pretty sure it was. The only time I saw that was when we were going back again. We went right through it when we were going back. I didn't notice it on the way down, but going back, somebody pointed it out, because there was a standing joke that 117 soldiers had been killed in action. It had actually been bombed. And the 117 were in action with the ladies rather than in action with the... the tale was, of course, that they were killed in action. Whether they got through to the channels or not, I don't know, but that was the story, that they'd been killed in action.
When you were in Alexandria, did you get the impression that there were a number of deserters about at this time?
No, we didn't realise that. There were stories about that at a later stage. But we did one night venture into Chinatown. I don't recall. I think it was somewhere on the points. There's a lovely beach that curves right round in Alexandria itself. And on the point of it was a place with ramshackles. And it was, we always knew this Chinatown. And we'd been up there for some reason, just looking around, I think, to see what was to be seen. And on the way back we were stoned. There's a gang came in behind us, and one from the side and one in front of us. And Frankie Hanley, he had two ribs damaged with stones. we were taken completely by surprise. And by the time we got ourselves pulled to, Frankie had been hit. Well, when we did get pulled to, we started retaliating, and they just left us. But this was the getting towards the time, you see, when there's some doubts as to whether we're going to be driven back to Alexandria again, which we were, of course, within about 2 months of this period. We were driven back again. So yes, there was some feeling in Alexandria. And of course, Farouk at one stage, about the same time, he had to be pegged down, and there was a guard put round his palace to because he had his yacht ready in Alexandria to dash up into his yacht, and I think he was going to be on the German side as well at one stage.
You mentioned letter cards. How were you receiving mail? Was it pretty regular? Were you getting back mail and parcels and this kind of thing?
It was reasonably good, yes. I can't just say how often it came, but it was reasonably good, because they had developed these things where they could make a microfilm and bring a lot through. And then there was the special airmail letter cards, which were quite light and a standard size, so they could be packed quite small. And then there was these forms with the numbers on, which you could say, I'm well, I'm in hospital, or hope you are well, and so forth. which again didn't take any space up. And the Army Post Office, you see, it's even today there is a post office company in the REs, in the TA of the REs, and they are made up mainly of postmen. They're nearly all postmen working in the post office today, but they have this company which is the post office company of the Royal Engineers. And they did really get down to brass tacks in the mail. In fact, we're told that even when 150 Brigade was more or less cut off, that they came into the box and travelled down the box to the minefield.